Good morning. Around the world, the effect of the UK vote to leave the EU continues to impact markets and the global future. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Later this hour, we'll get insight from news analyst Neil Conan. Meanwhile, it's a good and a decidedly not so good story for many Hawaii families. We'll look at the findings for both of those realities in the Kids Count data book.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Spiritual hypnotherapy is about going under to get well. Gail Barkley looks ahead to a workshop aimed at focusing the mind in order to set it free. And if you're one of those people who says, I just don't have rhythm, Deborah Masterson is out to prove you wrong. She's backing it up with a workshop to help you find the downbeat within.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, June 28th. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Hawaii's often touted as a great place for kids to grow up.
And sometimes we see data that shows that's not necessarily the case. But in this morning's first conversation, we're going to see sort of both sides of that conversation. Mm-hmm. Some better stats that are coming through and some economic data that shows that maybe we're not doing nearly as well as we should be doing.
Well, let's hear it.
All right. Now, over a six-year period from 2008 through 2014, life both worsened for Hawaii kids who fell into poverty, and it got better for teens. The better outcomes for teens is a bright spot in the 2016 Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count data book. It offers some relief to the other economic findings that puts Hawaii in the middle of the states based on four rankings for the health and well-being of families and children. Yvette Rodriguez-Stern is the project director of the Hawaii Kids Count Project. She's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so let's talk about that bright spot first. We need some bright spots these days. Life got better for teens, particularly for the teen birth rate.
Yes, and thank you for starting with the good news. So following the national trend, Hawaii's teens seem to be making progress. And so, yes, the birth rate decreased by 41%, but we also see a larger share of high school students graduating on time and a smaller share of teens engaging in risky behavior like substance abuse.
So to what do we attribute those better findings and outcomes for teens?
Well, I checked in with some providers and the folks at the Hawaii Youth Services Network, and indeed there have been efforts in the past decade or so in teen pregnancy prevention programs, and we see the impact of those programs with these data. And then when you look at some of the local findings in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, we see that that's consistent also with what the national Casey data show. And there, you know, we heard from the Department of Health and Department of Education that there also have been some important education and prevention efforts in our schools. So this is the outcome of prevention programs.
So in many ways, we're fortunate enough to be riding some coattails. And at this point, who cares if it's trending with national movements or not? As long as it's gotten better, that's a very, very good thing. But looking at what's happening to kids who are falling into poverty is not. What happened there?
So that's the bad news. Locally, we continue to see increases in the share of kids growing up in harsh economic conditions. So the child poverty rate increased between that period of time, with that increase being statistically significant. So even though we're below the national average, we just continue to increase in the number of kids growing up in poverty. We also have more kids whose parents lack secure employment. We have one of the highest rates of children living in households with a high housing cost burden, which means that more than 30% of the income is spent on housing costs. And we have more children living in high poverty neighborhoods.
not good news at all. How do you feel that, you know, we need to perhaps change the way we're looking at this data, given the fact that it's happened during a time which was, you know, economic good times? They were good years, those years that we were looking at in general, particularly the latter several years. Knowing that we're going to face a downturn in the not too distant future, most likely, if things are as cyclic as economists tell us, what happens to prevent further loss in the areas that we're already seeing some loss now?
So that's definitely the concern. You know, we've had some recovery in our economy. Clearly, some families with children have been left behind. The encouraging news, and I always like to focus on the positive, is that the Annie Casey Foundation and the data book, they do address some policy recommendations that are consistent with efforts that are gaining momentum in Hawaii, focused on increasing opportunity and reducing poverty. And one of those is something that we've talked about before in past years, increasing access to quality early childhood care and education. So we've had decades of research that just basically undeniably talks about the good outcomes for the children when they receive quality early care and education. But equally as importantly, working parents need access to care for their kids if, you know, they're going to hold down steady jobs. And we've had some recent victories in this area. In this past legislative session, there was increased funding to the preschool open door subsidy program, which then allows more low-income families to have access to care. But we have to maintain this funding. And we also have a small pre-K program in the DOE schools. So now we have to kind of examine, with nearly half of our kids still not in early care and learning programs, you know, is there growth that is needed?
When we had that question asked a few years ago, there were many people who said yes, but the resounding vote on that was no.
It was no, so we don't have a mixed state-funded program, but we were able to do something through the DOE. So it's more like, how do we work with what we have and expand these services to children?
So what would be the next best step, Yvette, for us to be able to serve more kids and keep them falling from where they are now into poverty because they don't have access to either quality daycare or real school?
Well, there's not one way of going at it. So, the you know, looking at early education and care and expanding that is one way of coming at it. Another recommendation from the Annie Casey Foundation, and again, something that's gaining momentum in Hawaii to ensure family economic security, especially in the face of a health care crisis or when a child is born, is looking at some type of paid family leave program. And that conversation, again, has started locally. We don't have anything that's currently mandated. It really depends on where you work. And in many cases, parents have to take leave without pay, which, again, if you're low income, that's really difficult. So there was recently legislation that didn't pass, but what we did get was a Senate resolution that establishes a task force to look at the costs and benefits of such a program in Hawaii.
Which some would say is another, you know, place where we fall back to a lot is, let's just study it, where we've had many people calling for paid family leave for quite some time. Anything that you see coming down for the next legislative session that might make this more of a reality, especially given some of these figures that we're looking at now in the Kids Count data?
We are definitely hoping that the study is conducted and we get some hard numbers on what it would cost the state so that our policymakers can make some clear decisions. And it's no matter what, it's going to take investments, whether it's early care and education or family economic security policy. It's going to take investments from the state, but these are things that we have to do because our children are our workforce in another 10 to 20 years, and they're the ones that are going to be taking care of both our economy and us, and we just want to make sure that they're prepared.
Yvette Rodriguez-Cern, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Always good to talk to you. Yvette Rodriguez-Cern is the project director of the Hawaii Kids Count Project at the University of Hawaii's Center on the Family. She's a social worker by training. Her work now focuses on family resiliency, especially in the presence of economic strain, and on promoting practices that strengthen families and foster their well-being. A link to the N.E. Casey Foundation's 2016 Kids Count Data Book is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:16 exactly. Coming up, going under via hypnosis in order to get well. But first, here's today's backyard quiz.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohawaii.
We've often discussed Hawaii's native and endangered species on the show, but we don't always mention that species distribution varies greatly throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii is home to dozens of endangered fauna, the majority of which are found nowhere else on Earth. Conversely, Hawaii is also home to many species that originate elsewhere on Earth but have made their way to Hawaii through human activity. One of these is the mongoose, which originally hails from India. It was introduced to Hawaii to control rat populations, but that didn't quite work out. And although mongooses are a common sight on many islands, the State Department of Land and Natural Resources reports no known populations on two of the main Hawaiian islands. Do you know which two islands those are? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get a T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Gerard Elmore from the Ohina Short Film Showcase. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
It's all too easy to be your own worst enemy, setting up internal barriers you don't even know are there, giving yourself reasons to fail before you've even made an effort. Those barriers are down there in your subconscious, not all that easy to reach, which is why some have come to embrace hypnotherapy. Gail Barkley is conducting a workshop on Maui this week for mental health professionals aimed at demonstrating what their patients can gain from allowing themselves to be hypnotized.
It's basically getting in touch with the spirit within you. That's the true essence of who you are in the process of hypnosis to help you get to your goals, your get through the blocks that are keeping you from where you want to go, and getting to what your purpose is, why you're here, what you're supposed to be doing in this lifetime.
What's the mental state that hypnosis takes you to?
Well, it's actually a really wonderful, peaceful, loving place where you can get in touch with the truth of who you are. We tend to do so much of our behavior and how we interact and speak in ways to please people around us, to make people happy or like us or buy our product or believe that we're honest, whatever it is. When we go into this space, it's just you. It's you have no one to please or make happy except for to get to your own truth. And when we get to that place, you know, the therapist is there to assist you and guide you, ask you questions. When we get to that place, we get our own personal clarity, and we find out, oh, what really makes us happy? What makes us tick? What's my personal passion? So I choose jobs or a profession that supports my passion. And when I do that, then everybody around me is happy because I'm a happy worker. I'm a happy, productive person in our society. Same thing goes with our relationships. When we get in clarity with ourselves about what kind of relationship we're supposed to be in, who we really want to be with, it's so wonderful for everyone around us.
Well, Gail, I understand that there are benefits. What I'm trying to get at is what happens. What happens under hypnosis?
What it looks like?
What it feels like, yeah.
What it feels like, good. Okay, well, basically, you go in with your therapist, and this could be in an individual setting or in a group setting. I, as the therapist, guide you to a relaxing place. A lot of times, I like to make it so that it's open-ended, and it's your relaxing place. So some people want to be taken to a specific garden or beach setting. Depending on the person, and usually I talk to them ahead of time, I find out what they like, and I guide them, hopefully, to their special place where they can relax and go deeper. And the body becomes very relaxed. I sometimes count down as if you're going down a staircase or down the steps into this beautiful garden where you notice the lush green grass where you can lay down and become peaceful. I sometimes take people into an imagery of clouds floating overhead where you can look up at the clouds and see different images. So your information comes to you. Not so much my information. I want to take you to a place where you can get your personal answers. I'm not going to tell you the answers that you need to know in life.
Well, Gail, you're always hearing about people who are resistant to hypnosis, that you know, some are far more difficult than others. Have you found that to be true?
There is some truth to it. But ultimately, when someone tells me that they're not hypnotizable, because people will come into the office and say that. I say, that's not a problem, but it's all your choice. All hypnosis is self-hypnosis. You have to want to do it. We all actually go into hypnosis every day constantly. And some examples are when you watch TV and you watch a commercial, you've sat down, you've already had dinner, you're full, you sit down after dinner, watch a TV commercial, and they show this really delicious pizza, and you go, oh, my gosh, I'm hungry. And then you go, wait a second, I just ate. And you know what? I don't even eat pizza. I'm allergic to cheese and wheat. That's not even me. But for those few seconds, you were hypnotized. And a hypnotic state is any space where you are focused intently on one subject matter, and every external sound goes away. It's not important, and you go into that place. Now, unlike a commercial that gets you to do things you don't want to do, in hypnotherapy, we come up with, we the therapist and client, what it is you want in life. What's your goal? And it could be as simple as stopping smoking or, you know, losing weight. Or it could be, I need to figure out what my life purpose is. We discuss that ahead of time, and then the therapist guides the client to finding that information. And all of that information is within ourselves. And that is the, quote, spirit part of it. It's the higher self, the wise self within ourselves that really, truly knows what is best for us. Sometimes people talk about hearing the voices, you know, the good demon on the shoulder or the angel on the shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, all of that's part of us. and we just have to get to that part and make it productive. Did I answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, because I guess it comes down to kind of a definition of, as you were saying that, I was just sort of wondering how one would actually define hypnosis. Because what you're talking about is acute concentration.
Acute concentration with intense relaxation.
And then that helps you sort of connect to who you are.
And what you want in life. What directions, what goals, how to set up the process, the step-to-step is one of the things that we end up doing after we get the answers. How are we going to put this into place? Now, one of the beautiful benefits is after we get through all of that aspect of it, we set it in motion with the strength of the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind processes 40,000 bits of information per second versus the conscious mind that can handle 5 to 7 bits of information. So when we work in the subconscious mind, it also is a place where all thoughts and beliefs and concepts are created and stored. So when we go back to that same place, we can literally shift and change whatever we want for a healthier outcome.
Gail Barkley will conduct a Divine Wisdom Hypnotherapy Workshop this Thursday and Friday at the Temple of Peace in Haiku, Maui. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
The Lowdown swindlers, visionaries, and crackpots who helped bring about one of the most extraordinary engineering feats of the 19th century, the Erie Canal. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Public radio is people. Of course, that means our staff here in Hawaii and our broadcast colleagues across the nation and around the world. Add in our more than 200 program sponsors and our approximately 13,000 members, and it's easy to see how people drive this operation, including paying for it. Thank you to members whose donations provide 65% of our annual budget, including these member donors: Craig DeSilva of Honolulu, Patrick and Leah Reneerson of Mountain View, and Ruby Mizue of IAEA. As an HPR listener, you're our kind of people, too, and HPR needs your support. An easy online membership form is at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. The list is out, and today we know what's on the governor's proposed veto agenda. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is back with a parting of the ways reality check, including over the Airbnb bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
That last one is going to make Senator Laura Thielen very happy.
Yes, it is.
She campaigned so actively against that Airbnb bill. What did the governor have to say about his reasons for vetoing it?
Well, let me just tell you what that bill would have done, or will do if it does become law, but it doesn't look like that's going to be the case right now. What it would do is require companies that have vacation rentals, like Airbnb, to help the state collect taxes. And, of course, lawmakers always looking for more revenue, and that's why it was such an attractive deal. But people like Laura Thielen, whose district includes Kailua and Waimanalo, areas with big beaches, said really the bill would sell out public beaches and lands. There would be, you know, all sorts of tents popping up here and there. And there were other concerns as well. And so the governor said that it is on his proposed list. He says there could be unintended consequences if the bill became law. He prefers the administration work with the counties on rules and regulations to stop illegal vacation rentals.
Okay, let's move on just in the interest of time. What did he have to say about the Kaiser Permanente, sort of, you know, what some people called sweetheart deal for members who are going to be out of work?
Right. So this is the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation, three hospitals, two in Maui County, one on Lanai. They're going to be privatized with Kaiser. That deal is going through. The challenge is what to do about the union employees, particularly the UPW workers that may lose their jobs. Well, the legislature came up with a deal. $40 million is the estimate. Help them with a severance payment or a pension bonuses to help them get through these times. But critics said, boy, that seems like an awfully generous deal. The governor yesterday said they're still reviewing it. They're looking at fiscal, legal, policy aspects. Remember that the UPW actually sued over this privatization deal. Right now, the state and the union are negotiating to settle that case.
Of the other bills that we have yet to talk about, were there any real surprises for you?
Well, I think the one that was one of the most contentious issues was the Alexander and Baldwin water bill. I'll to call it by another name, but in
but
short, the governor's he signed it yesterday, and he said that he recognizes there are problems with the bill. He said there are he had reservations actually, but what was most important to him was to help A and B transition from sugarcane to diversified ag, and to do that, they need that water from East Maui diverted to Central Maui. Well, the Sierra Club says really what you're doing is you're helping a for-profit company at the expense of not only state law but also public interest. The governor insisted that water remains a public trust. The bill just gives A and B and the state a little more time. So that was probably one of the most controversial issues. Settled for now, but probably, I'll just say certainly will come up again as an issue, particularly on this program, I'm sure, Beth Ann.
You bet. Okay. But of those other bills that are on the veto list, anything there that you think is, you know, particularly glaring?
One that kind of caught my attention was a bill that would prohibit employers from accessing or obtaining their employees' social media accounts, right? Passwords for Facebook or Twitter. Well, the governor said, is it really happening that much? Do we have the resources in the state labor department? So that appears to not make the cut, but certainly gives one pause. One doesn't want one's boss looking at one's social media. So that was the other one that kind of caught my eye.
Okay, and we won't ask you for what reasons, but we'll leave it there. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks,
Chad.
Bye-bye.
Chad Blair reports for his Civil Beat. Every day he joins us with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, celebrating 50 years of educating students from Hawaii, the mainland, and around the world, offering 50 undergraduate and 14 graduate degrees. hpu.edu.
Markets around the world recovered some ground today after those scary losses following Britain's referendum last week. But political uncertainty continues on both sides of the Atlantic. Both of Britain's major parties are in chaos. The leadership of the EU is trying to come to terms with its greatest challenge to date. And the Trump and Clinton campaigns are trying to gauge lessons learned. So this week, it's one big story with several threads on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan, who usually joins us most Tuesdays from his farm on the Big Island. Today finds him traveling in Wyoming. He joins us from there. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We just crossed South Pass in the Wind River Mountains in the Continental Divide, so we're just outside of Lander, Wyoming.
All right. Well, we're glad to talk to you wherever you are. Now, were you as surprised as I was that the British voters opted out of the EU?
Oh, yes. The polls showed the referendum pretty close, but and they weren't far wrong, but the betting markets were way off, 70-30, something like that. Just after the polls closed, Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party said he thought Leave had suffered a narrow defeat. So, yes, definitely surprised. Most experts thought that in the decisive moment in the election booth, most people would make the safe decision, but they chose disruption instead.
Right. That word disruption figuring prominently, and that's exactly why so many people are wondering about the relevance to our election, where we have one candidate who has been described as safe and cautious, and another who seems to actually define disruption.
That's right. And let's extend the analogy to include the fact that both Donald Trump and the British Leave campaigns put immigration front and center, both focus on anger with far-off bureaucrats and the economic struggles of the working class. Both campaigns can be described as nativist as well as populist. Both are willing to appeal to racism, and both are headed by, you know, wealthy demagogues. Nigel Farage, he called last Thursday Britain's Independence Day, and of course Donald Trump, who cheered the British result and scheduled a speech in Pennsylvania today to rail against free trade agreements, pretty much the same thing.
So what are the major differences?
Well, the vote in Britain was about an idea, while we will be choosing between two very different candidates, two people. Yes, there's the anger of the white working class that Trump's tapped into, but the college-educated are a bigger part of the U.S. electorate. Minorities are a much bigger part. Donald Trump has alienated a huge percentage of women across the board as well, and many minority groups, of course. He still has major problems within his own party. He has a serious gap to make up in fundraising and campaign staff, and the most recent polls show him with significant deficits both nationally and in most of the swing states, and that's a major difference too, Beth. And the U.S. election is not a contest for the popular vote. It's 51 separate elections, and the Democrats begin with important advantages in the Electoral College.
Still, though, I mean, all of this has to be a real gut check, with Donald Trump's candidacy looking a little more plausible than it did even a week ago.
Very much. Yes, I think that's right. And another analogy, you know, half-hearted support from the left. Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, the very left-wing leader of the Labour Party, who only campaigned for Remain in the last couple of days. He refused to appear with Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron and Leave won big in most Labour areas. Bernie Sanders has yet to endorse Hillary Clinton. He did say he would vote for her, but in remarks that might define half-hearted. But another difference, Liberal champion Elizabeth Warren made her first campaign with Secretary Clinton last night in Cincinnati.
This is true. And that was a full-throated endorsement, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And we could expect the same when President Obama hits the stump with Secretary Clinton, and we'll see a major contrast in a couple of weeks at the conventions. There's going to be a lot of focus on who does not show up in Cleveland. The last two Republican presidents, the last two Republican presidential candidates, just to begin with. Mm-hmm. Well, Secretary Clinton will begin with the complete endorsement of the sitting, and according to those same polls, solidly popular president of the United States with her former president husband, with Senator Warren, maybe a surprise Republican or two, and I suspect Senator Sanders will come around as well.
Okay, we've got a little time before we actually get to Cleveland and Philadelphia, but for the moment I want to focus on Britain. Everybody accepted that Prime Minister Cameron would be in trouble if the Leave campaign actually won. He quickly announced his plans to resign, but why is Jeremy Corbyn facing a revolt from members in Parliament in the Labour Party?
Corbyn has never been popular with Labour MPs. Remember that he was elected leader after Ed Miliband led Labour to disaster in the general election a couple of years ago. The consensus was that he may have been too left-wing for the electorate. Instead of swinging back toward the center, the membership of the Labour Party picked an even more leftist replacement. The party membership, not his fellow MPs, many of whom see Corbyn as a quixotic, eccentric, difficult, and as poorly organized. With the Conservatives in chaos now, deeply split, a lot of people suspect there will be another general election soon to sort out the post-Brexit landscape. Most Labour MPs worry that Corbyn would mean another defeat for Labour, so replace him now, they say. He lost a vote of no confidence among his parliamentary members today. He's going to appeal to the party membership that selected him in the first place. As of yet, it's unclear how this is going to work out.
Stay with that post-Brexit landscape for a second. One consequence in the not-too-distant future could be another referendum on Scottish independence.
Absolutely right, and maybe one in Northern Ireland, too. Both these areas voted strongly for Remain. In Scotland, the pro-independent First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said a new referendum is now very likely. Her Scots Nats party lost that referendum just a couple of years ago. She wants to see solid support for independence for maybe 6 months running before she risks another vote. Northern Ireland is interesting because so much contact and trade across the border with the rest of Ireland. With Brexit, that border becomes a solid border between an EU country and the North as part of Britain. Most Northern Irish nationalists, that's the Catholics, voted Remain. Most loyalists, the Protestants, voted Leave. So it's hard to see how an independence referendum would not devolve into the same old sectarian argument in Northern Ireland, but we'll see. One part of Britain that's really worried right now is Gibraltar, which voted something like 95% Remain, so they wanted to keep their open border with Spain.
And what about a larger exit? I mean, right-wing parties in France and the Netherlands quickly were calling for referendums of their own. Is this the beginning of what could be the end for the European project?
Maybe. And I think that has to worry everybody west of Moscow. But we're all, we're ways away from that. And right now it's going to be interesting to see if the EU punishes Britain in the upcoming negotiations to warn those who may want to follow suit. If Britain insists on immigration control, and that's what a lot of this referendum was about, I don't see how Europe can agree to give them access to the single market. And while the Leave campaign has already backtracked on a lot of promises, I don't see how they can flip-flop on immigration.
I would love to talk more, but in the interest of time, we have to say goodbye. But we'll talk to you next week. Will you still be in Wyoming?
We'll be in Montana next week.
All right. Well, the phone works there, too, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
News analyst Neil Conan usually joins us from the farm most Tuesdays. You can also hear his specific news minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. And now we're going to move into the past to get the answer to our backyard quiz. Today we asked you about one of Hawaii's most prolific foreign invaders, the mongoose. First introduced in 1883 to control rats on sugar plantations, the mongoose was very successful in adapting to its new home, but not very successful at killing rats. As it turned out, mongooses are diurnal, meaning they come out during the day, whereas rats are nocturnal. As a result, the mongooses introduced to Hawaii didn't have much contact with rats. What they do come into contact with are the eggs of native birds, many highly endangered. Fortunately for the birds, two of the main Hawaiian islands never let the mongoose be introduced to their ecosystems. They are Kauai and Lanai. And although sporadic sightings have been reported on Kauai, DLNR reports no known population.
And Beth Ann Nancy Marker of Mo'ili'ili knew that, so she will get an HPR t-shirt, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
For the backyard quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Every culture has its own distinctive rhythms, and they're inside us, whether we know it or not. Yet there are many who say they just don't have rhythm. Somehow, a fundamental connection has been lost. Deborah Masterson has studied rhythms all around the world, and she says immersion in the rhythms all around us, learning to create rhythms and move in concert with them, can both help us and heal us. And she's on the phone with us from Hawaii Island. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, you often hear of the so-called harmony of the spheres, but you don't hear as much about the rhythm, and yet it's just as much a part of the way the universe is put together, don't you think?
Well, rhythm is the absolute core of how everything is put together, in my opinion. It underlies not only music, but nature and life and your relationship to others. It's absolutely essential.
So how did we get away from it? You know, I too have run into this thing of people who say, I don't have rhythm, and It's like, how could you how could you not, right?
How could you not? Your heart is beating. When you walk, you take one step and then another step. Everything, your nervous system, the sun rising and setting, the seasons and the year, absolutely everything is rhythm. And I, you know, I don't want to blame media, but
why not?
You know, everybody's glued to their phone in a passive way, yeah. You know, and you see people sitting on Facebook watching, you know, Africans, Indonesians, you know, Latvians doing these incredible rhythm things.
Yeah.
But, you know, what we need is to get out there and feel it, not think it, not monkey mind it, but feel it in our bodies.
One of the things I think that people run into with any kind of music making is the notion that you have to be good at it, whatever that means, right?
And we are good at it. What my classes do is give everybody at every level a way to experience and explore where they are, and to at the same time draw on the power of the collective to help them in their journey.
The power of the collective meaning having other people around them that are knocking out the rhythm?
It's a circle. It's a circle of people. It's a collective of people that just want to, instead of think it, they want to feel it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned looking at, you know, videos from around the world, and when you see a tribal culture making rhythm and making dance, it's not something in which everyone participates, right?
Well, it is. I mean, if you think about it, it's often so simple. When you see those videos of the, you know, the African villages, the little kids, they're beating on sticks, they're stepping,
yeah,
they're being rocked on the back of their mothers. That's how these cultures keep this power, this magic, this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But when we, you know, when we all retreat to our little bedrooms with our phones in our hands, we lose that. And this is a way to get back.
Well, how does that play out in the course of one of your workshops? What's the?
Well, like I said, it's a circle of people, and we begin with very, very simple syllables as a guide. The syllables have no meaning; they're just a guide for moving into rhythm, and then we translate those syllables to a step, very simple step,
uh-huh,
often just like walking. And then we begin to add complexity. We might add claps, we might add a little rattle in one hand, and we weave it all together to create a polyrhythm, which is actually quite complex.
Yeah, yeah.
But we do it very slowly and very gently, and excuse me, people are invited to take the pieces that they feel comfortable with, that resonate within them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the collective, we have the rhythm. It's in the room. Even if everyone lies down on the floor, which they are invited to do, it continues. You still hear it. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a way for people to participate at the, you know, quote-unquote level they are capable of, and to make music together.
Well, Deborah, with a polyrhythm, you know, when you're playing in a musical ensemble and you're playing polyrhythms, it might be your assignment to go 1-2-3, 1-2-3 when everyone else is going 1-2-3-4, and
yes,
and your beats only intersect every, you know,
yep,
every 12 times, and
right,
so you have to be confident about keeping that going, not being confused by what you hear around you, right?
Well, actually, my workshops are all about being confused.
All right.
Because we're not there to learn 3 and 4. We are there to look at the way each of us as an individual learns, and to, in a safe space, to be held by that rhythm and to listen, which is a lost art, to feel it in whatever way we can, and to contribute, but most importantly, just to listen to each other. And it always comes together. It's miraculous. It's just, I love it.
Once you find yourself able to lock in rhythmically in an mm-hmm. ensemble or in a dance situation, you kind of there's kind of a growth of confidence that it's working, right?
Exactly. What happens is, I'll tell you what happens in my circles, is the minute somebody locks in, I can see in their face, they go to this place where they say in their head, they go straight up to their brain and they say, ooh, I've got it, and immediately they don't. So what this is about is that repeated experience of chaos and order, and chaos and order, and chaos and order, and each time you fall into chaos and you stop, you breathe, you feel the people around you, and you reemerge at a higher level of order. And that's how this builds, is step by step.
So what you're saying, when you say when you start thinking about it, you lose it?
Absolutely. This is for sure. Unless you are, you know, the master percussionist of the world. And even if you are, I recall my teacher, I once asked my teacher in this process, you know, how do you lead this? Because it's so complicated and you have so many pieces. And how do you not fall out? And he says, I fall out every second and I fall back in. I just do it faster than you do.
Hmm.
And that's what makes this process so dynamic, is because you are constantly out in, out in, out in. And the more you do it, as he said, the slower you go, the faster you go.
It sounds like a lot to take in, but the way to really learn is just to be there with other people, is what it sounds like, Deborah.
It's exactly. It's just being present, just paying attention to what is now, and what invariably flummoxes people is when they start to think, oh, she's doing it better than I am, or I'm doing it better than he is, or, oh, now I've got it, or, you know, oh, I finally figured it out. And that is always the moment where you see their face just go, oh, whoops, and then the smile comes, and they're back.
Well, we're back now, Deborah. Thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I just want to say I am a member of HPR since 1984, and I encourage everyone, please support this wonderful station.
Well said, Deborah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Deborah Masterson will conduct a rhythm full circle workshop the second Friday of each month at the Kalani Honua Retreat in Pahoa on Hawaii Island. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Deborah Masterson's rhythm workshops are directed at people who say, I just can't feel the rhythm. And it really does seem as if something has gotten we've gotten detached from our origins if rhythm isn't a part of our lives.
So. I mean, that whole business about the rhythm of life, and there have been, you know, lots of songs that's shown up in so many places. But because it's true, and her point about, you know, retreating to your bedroom with your phone and what happens when we all sort of check out, maybe we are missing a lot of the rhythms of life, including many in our own.
Well, we'll try to bring them back. All we can do, right?
Well, it was fun to listen to her, and thanks very much for joining us this morning. Now, coming up tomorrow, we're going to get the long view with Neil Milner.
And the All the World's a Stage Theater Company will look at the dark side of genius.
In the meantime, if you have something to tell us, lots of places for you to do that. You can do it on our TalkBack line. That's 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like social, we're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkrug.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation.